From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2004, filmmaker Morgan Spurlock stormed onto the Hollywood scene with his startling documentary hit Super Size Me. The premise was simple. He put himself on a McDonald's-only diet for 30 days, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And the rule was, if he was asked to supersize his meal, he would.
Hello, can I help you?
Yeah, could I get the double quarter pounder with cheese meal? I think I'm going to have to go supersize.
Audiences loved it. The drama of watching Spurlock eat his way through the entire McDonald's menu and then come to grips with the devastating consequences was irresistible and more than a little horrifying. This summer, he's set his one-month immersion formula loose on the rest of America in his six-part TV series, 30 Days. He and his fiancée live for a month on minimum wage. A devout Christian moves in with a Muslim family. A gone-to-seed former athlete turns to steroids and anti-aging drugs. In each episode, Spurlock's subjects throw themselves into an unfamiliar lifestyle with lasting epiphanies for the world to see. Tonight on Point, filmmaker Morgan Spurlock on his rough and ready experiment, Living Lives in 30 Days. You can join the conversation tonight. Did you follow Morgan Spurlock on his Super Size Me expedition? Are you up for 30 days in an American experience that may be very different from your own? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Morgan Spurlock, Academy Award-nominated director of Super Size Me. He is the creator, producer, and host of the six-part documentary TV series 30 Days on FX. The final episode, Binge Drinking Mom, airs tomorrow night. Morgan Spurlock, welcome. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you're deep into it now. Super Size Me, you were kind of a novice, or at least you seemed like a newcomer. Now you're into a whole series through the summer. You got it up on FX. We're going to talk about those episodes tonight, and they are fascinating. But how's the experience going? How do you like it?
I mean, it's just been so much so fast. It's really it's exciting. It's overwhelming. And, you know, I feel very fortunate.
So I know you don't like the phrase reality TV applied to your work, but I guess that's just because you don't like what most of reality TV is. When I look at your work, I see reality TV. How about it?
Well, I think, you know, we've created a show with 30 days that actually, you know, is dealing with reality, you know, finally for the first time. You know, nobody's getting voted off. Nobody's winning $1 million. You know, so we've created an environment that I think really is tackling some difficult subjects in our society.
And and you drew it out of your experience with McDonald's. How did you first stumble into the idea of gorging on that?
I had an epiphany somewhere in there amidst the fries and the shakes. Actually, it was during post-production while we were editing Super Size Me. We had a test screening of the film, and you know, after the test screening, we're asking the audience for feedback, and they started kind of arguing with one another about what the film really meant, what it meant to them, and it really evoked a very strong, very visceral reaction, a very personal reaction from the audience. And for me, the next day when we went back and we were in the edit room, I said to the editor, Stella, I said, you know, it would be great to create a show where we could deal with different social issues on a weekly basis that would evoke that kind of emotion. And that was kind of the you know, beginning of 30 Days.
And here you are. You took that idea around to the major networks. They didn't go for it. What kind of response did you get?
Well, we started meeting with the big networks, and you know, one network executive said, "Oh, hold on a second. So, who wins this show?" And you know, we said, "Well, you know, you do, the viewer, every week by watching." And they said, "Well, it's been nice meeting you."
And out you went.
And that was kind of the end of that.
FX.
Yeah, and FX, you know, it was interesting because FX was Ben Silverman is the guy who we partner with at Reveille to sell this show, and he's, you know, he's the guy who brought kind of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire to America. A lot of these shows that you know, came from foreign countries. And he said from the beginning, he said, you know, I know exactly where this show needs to go. And it was FX. That was his first choice as well. And when we sat down and met with them, I mean, they just got it. You know, they knew what we wanted to create. They knew what my goals were for the show. And it kind of fit their brand of pushing, you know, creating programming that kind of pushes the envelope and pushes the viewer to a different level.
The last in this series runs tomorrow night, Binge Drinking Mom. And you're going to have to explain to us the redeeming social value in that one. I'm sure you will. But before we go there and look into these others, how's it gone? Is FX happy with what they got out of this?
I mean, I think FX is very happy. You know, they tell me they are. So, and the ratings have been fantastic. And I run into so many people on the street who have been deeply affected by the episodes they've seen. You know, I mean, it's made a very lasting impact. And for me, I think it's taking a step in a new direction of showing that, you know, we can create thought-provoking, you know, quote-unquote reality programming that, you know, that doesn't have to be gross-out television, that doesn't have to be shocking, that can actually, you know, have some redeeming social qualities. And at the same point, at the same time, be very entertaining. I mean, the show is very fun. Funny. It's very engaging, and I think at the same point, you know, very informative and enlightening.
I'll vouch for that. I really enjoy these. I have to say, we've talked a little bit about them, but I wish you'd walk us through the half dozen 30-day segments that, that you're just in the process of airing.
Yeah, in the premiere episode, and that's the other thing people need to know if they've missed it. You know, the season finale is tomorrow night, but starting next week, FX is going to be having marathons where they're going to be running all the episodes in the upcoming weeks. So people who've missed them will get to check them out.
Catch it if you can. They're really interesting. But walk us through.
So in the premiere episode, which, you know, when I originally went to FX with the series, went with the idea, the goal was, you know, the original idea was I'm going to do all of them. Like, I'm going to go away in each episode and for 30 days, you know, experience something that I think is kind of an important, you know, issue in our nation today. And that was the original plan. And then as I started, you know, diving into, you know, we started developing these projects and ideas. Mm-hmm. And my girlfriend said, if you do that, you're not going to have a girlfriend very long. And I said, well, how about if I do one? And she said, okay, fine. If you do one and you go away for a month, I'm going to come with you wherever you are. And so that's when we settled on living on minimum wage. And I think, you know, having her along for the ride, first off, she's the most patient and understanding woman on the whole planet to continue to put up with me.
This is famously vegan chef fiance, Alexandra Jameson.
Yes, and she's a saint of a woman.
And we saw that on film.
And seeing her in the show, but I think, you know, having her come along for the minimum wage episode really legitimized it in so many ways for me, and I think for people who saw the show, because it really was real. It was a couple struggling, you know, to make ends meet. It was a couple struggling with money, and it was, you know, for me, I think it was much more important having someone there because, you know, it really started affecting Alex much different from me. You know, I'm a very happy-go-lucky person, you know, by nature, and it wasn't that way for her.
Morgan, we're going to go back and walk through each of these, but take us on through that list. It was 30 days on minimum wage.
30 days on minimum wage, and then the next one where there was a guy who had kind of lost his stamina, lost his you know, beautiful physique when he was a high school college athlete. He was a swimmer and he'd gotten a little fat, so he wanted to regain it. And so for 30 days, he went on a treatment of you know, human growth hormone, testosterone, and steroids.
Talk about supersize me. That's another path there. Then you had a straight man, 30 days with a gay couple in San Francisco.
A guy from Michigan moved in, an ex-military, Army reservist, homophobe, moved in with this guy in San Francisco for 30 days in the Castro District, which is another great show. There was a Christian from my home state of West Virginia who moved in with a Muslim family in Dearborn, Michigan to kind of learn, you know, just what it's like to be a Muslim in America. There was a couple from New York, a couple of, you know, hardcore all-American consumers, people who don't recycle, who drive SUVs, who, you know, spend money and, you know, pump up, you know, their gas every week. And we took them to Missouri, where they moved on to an experimental eco village where they lived off the grid for 30 days. And then tomorrow night is the season finale, which is the binge drinking mom, where I mean, this episode I think is really important because there's so many of us who have gone through it. I mean, I know I as a college student did, and I know a lot of parents who have kids in college who go through it. You go to college and suddenly you know you get into this lifestyle of going out 3, 4, 5, 6 days a week. You know, that her daughter is a freshman at Arizona State and is a big partier, goes out quite a bit, and the mother doesn't think she sees the impact she's having on her life, on the people around her, the ramifications of her actions. And so to try and instill in the daughter and try and make the daughter see what she's doing to herself, the mom herself becomes a binge drinker, much like the daughter. And it's I mean, it's really powerful. It's powerful television.
We're going to look into these. I want to go back and just get a sense of how you began to wade in with Supersize Me. Here's a brief clip from Morgan Spurlock in Supersize Me, eating his last meal with his vegan chef girlfriend, Alexandra, before going on his all-McDonald's diet for 30 days.
We have a vegetable tart and a quinoa and roasted veggie salad, artichokes and a simple green salad, all beautiful, organic, fresh vegetables that you're going to miss so much.
What am I going to have that's organic?
In the next month, nothing.
Nothing.
You're only going to have genetically modified potatoes.
I'm going to eat as many vegetables as I can tonight.
There's plenty here for you.
That's really good.
It's good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Have they improved their cookies in the last 10 years? Because the last time I had them, they were like little hockey pucks.
I don't know. We'll see.
Big fat target on his first time at bat, Morgan Spurlock taking on McDonald's. I wanted to ask you, we just got a minute before the break here, but
sure.
Having taken on a huge advertiser like McDonald's, are you blackballed for life from major networks that get a lot of advertising from McDonald's?
You know, I don't think you'll ever see Super Size Me playing on any of the major four networks. But, you know, it did play on Showtime. It has played on cable. I think it'll end up playing on basic cable. And, you know, just like with 30 Days, you know, I think that advertisers don't shy away from something that they believe is successful. And, you know, that was a concern that FX had. But advertisers are still coming there because people are watching the show. And I think a lot of them realize the important inherent value in programming like this.
And do you nod to Michael Moore, or is he on the other side? I mean, you're funny like Michael Moore, you're pointed like Michael Moore. I don't feel quite the political hatchet that Michael Moore can pull out in your work.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I like Michael's films, and I respect his work quite a bit. And he's definitely somebody. If it hadn't been for him, you know, a film like Super Size Me never would have made it in the theaters. I mean, that's a fact. And for me, what I always tell people is, like, whether or not you agree with Michael Moore and what he says, I think that it's important that we have people who shake the trees, who question what's going on around us in the world, because that's important. That's what America's all about.
Well, this is my kind of reality TV. We're going to come back and look more closely at it. Morgan Spurlock, please stand by. We're talking tonight with Super Size Me filmmaker Morgan Spurlock about his new documentary series, 30 Days, and his great experiment with real reality TV. His Super Size Me, third highest grossing documentary of all time, only behind Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 and Bowling for Columbine. You can join us tonight. Did you take the Super Size Me trip with Morgan Spurlock? Can you imagine what you'd learn walking 30 days in the shoes of a very different American? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Supersize me.
Put something in your mouth.
Supersize me.
Can I get extra cheese with that?
Supersize me.
What do you mean 50 cents for extra cheese? Supersize me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Super Size Me filmmaker Morgan Spurlock about his new documentary series, 30 Days, and his big experiment with real reality TV. You can join the conversation tonight. Why is most reality TV so unreal? And have you seen Spurlock's work? Do you see what sets it apart? Why don't the major networks pick up truly challenging shows like 30 Days? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Morgan Spurlock, nominated for an Academy Award for Super Size Me, also author of Don't Eat This Book, Fast Food and the Supersizing of America, King of All Media. I see Morgan Spurlock there getting into publishing as well. Take us into your formula, how it works, and for example, how did you apply it to the minimum wage 30 days?
I mean, the biggest thing for us was to try and make the experience as realistic as we could, because even in 30 days, you're never going to get a full immersion. But we wanted to make it as close to it as a full immersion as we could. You know, at the end of a 30 days, you know, Alex and I still had the ability to go home.
Right.
But what we wanted to do is basically strip away everything we could that would have those safety nets for us. You know, so we didn't have credit cards. We didn't have, you know, a lot of things to fall back on. And we really had to start from scratch, you know, in terms of finding a place to live, of finding jobs. You know, we didn't go out and find these things beforehand like a lot of shows do. You know, we didn't script anything. You know, there weren't like set up events that were happening. What you're seeing is kind of 30 days unfold in everyone's life over the course of this journey as they kind of find things out on their own. And for me, I think that's an important part of the process.
I thought this was just terrific. You point out at the very outset that the minimum wage has not budged since 1997. It's $5.15 an hour. That's $10,000 a year. You and Alexander both got jobs, so you could put those together. But I mean, each of you just bringing home $178 a week. We'll have listeners who know what that's like and many who do not. It is rough to live on. You go out looking for an apartment and the landlord says, well, you know, this is a little bit rougher neighborhood, but you've got the hospital right here across the street.
Right, great. Exactly. And we started looking for an apartment and there were people who they were wanting first and last month's rent. And how do you do that? I mean, if it's a $400 a month apartment, how do you pay $800 to move somewhere? I mean, it's really, really impossible at times.
Let's hear just a little bit of that. Here's Morgan Spurlock and his fiancée, Alexandra Jameson, tallying their money after a month of living on minimum wage.
Well, let's just go through all of our money.
Let's
see
count
what
up what we got.
That's 100. That's 200. 300. 600. 835. 14. That's 470.
Okay. That's rent.
Our gas and water.
Just 1208.
We have to pay your phone bill. I mean, the biggest bills we have is the hospital bills, which is $1,217.
Well, it's hard to make it add up. I was what's the right word? Almost touched by the way you went at this without a lot of attitude, just kind of plunging into it the way someone might if they were suddenly just out on the hustings, needed a job and had to get a minimum wage job. And you weren't soaking us in attitude at every moment here, just kind of plowing on through.
I mean, for me, I think it's really important just to kind of, for one, just to be myself, and just kind of, let the things that happen around me happen around me. And I think that's what you see in everybody who goes through their own little 30-day journeys in the series, is we wanted to find people who were confident enough to kind of be themselves, to speak their minds, but at the same point didn't have blinders so completely on that they weren't going to be receptive to what was happening around them. And for me, that's why I think casting is such an important part of the show, of finding the right people who are open, to making themselves vulnerable, because that's what the show really is about, is letting your guard down, making yourself vulnerable in a situation that you normally wouldn't put yourself in.
I thought that was very evident in your segment on the West Virginia young man, Christian, who went to live with a Muslim family in Dearborn, Michigan for 30 days. Dearborn, perhaps the most Muslim community in America. I mean, it is intensely Islamic community. You had your young married man, kind of a Matt Damon lookalike, and suddenly he's wearing the big skull cap, growing the beard, putting on the tunic. And he's into another world.
Completely. And I think this whole immersion was something that was so overwhelming for him in the beginning. The guy travels extensively for his work. He's an insurance salesman, and he'd never been stopped and gotten the wand in an airport. And so suddenly here he shows up, wearing his kufi and his full Muslim regalia, and gets stopped immediately and got searched his way out of Charleston, West Virginia. So, I think from then, at that very moment on day one, he knew he was going to be in for something that he couldn't quite put his finger on or even really know what to expect.
And describe the toughest moments for him. Remind me of his name is David Stacy. That's right. Remind me of the toughest moments of his journey through just 30 days in an Islamic household, in an Islamic community.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that David is a devout Christian, and I think he had a lot of his struggles came from his faith, of having struggles with his faith, having struggles with what the imam was telling him, how, there's one God that we all pray to, it's just we all pray differently, but there's only one God. And so David was having a big struggle with that, and what the imam was telling him, and was having, difficulty going through the motions. Even being there was difficult for him. And there's a great scene where he goes to Juma, the Juma prayer that they have every Friday, where he goes there and actually is just there taking in this prayer, and you see him cry. It was an incredibly emotionally powerful experience for him.
Let's listen to David Stacy again, Christian from West Virginia with a Dearborn, Michigan Muslim family, explaining here why he's uncomfortable praying in Arabic.
Not knowing what was being said in Arabic, I really had a huge panic attack. I don't know if part of the prayers is to condemn Christianity or the Holy Trinity.
Allahu Akbar. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahu Akbar.
If I'm reciting Arabic, I have no idea what I'm saying, and I'm compromising my moral being.
Subhana Rabbiyal A'la wa bihamdihi.
For me to pray to another God makes me feel like I'm going to be turning my back on my own God.
Allahu Akbar.
Of course, there's David Stacy, a West Virginia Christian who spent 30 days with a Muslim family in a Muslim community, Dearborn, Michigan, in Morgan Spurlock's series 30 Days. And of course, in the end, he's not asked to accept another God, but he gets a huge dose of understanding across a line that he never would have crossed otherwise. And I guess that's the core of what you're doing here, Morgan, is shipping Americans across lines that they would not cross in their ordinary life, despite how diverse the country is and the diversity all around us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, this idea of tolerance and just, the imam said something to David in that episode that I think really sums up the entire series of 30 days when David was questioning, why he was there. And he says, well, I don't think I believe, what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And the imam said to him, he goes, David, you're here to learn, not to believe. Mm-hmm. And for me, that really, it's such a simple sentiment that really is what the show is all about. It's about learning about other people. It's about learning about this country, this culture, this world that we live in, maybe not believing 100% that what these the people are saying is true, but at least accepting that, these people can believe something different than you.
It wasn't always easy going across that line, but I was so impressed with how he began freaked out. I mean, he's got his skull cap and his tunic, and as soon as he hits the airport, he's being eyed by everybody. He says, everyone's looking at me like I'm John Walker Lind.
Right.
And the call to prayer goes off at 5:30 in the morning and all the rest. He's in very strange territory, but he comes back clearly comforted at knowing these fellow Americans better. He's not a Muslim. He's probably never going to be one, but he knows them now as people.
Yeah, and I think for me that's such an important part of 30 Days and this whole series is it really humanizes, you know, people that we've maybe had, you know, different stereotypes about or we've kind of summed up in one certain way. And for me, the Hawks, you know, which is the Muslim family that he goes to live with in Dearborn. I mean, I applaud this couple. They're a young couple, professional couple. They were born here in the United States. They are American Muslims. And you know, for them to open up their home and once again, making themselves vulnerable, just like David did, you know, to the scrutiny of American audiences is something I'm very proud of.
Both very foreign in some aspects of their lives to other Americans, in others totally familiar. As David Stacy finally walks out the door after saying a really heartfelt, warm goodbye, and just after the door closes, he makes a gesture at the door. Just after the door closes, the Muslim husband says to his wife, "Did he just flip us off?" And she says, "No, he gave us a peace sign." And they kind of collapse in laughter.
And she said, "Dude,"
moment.
And she throws the dude on at the end. She goes, "It's a peace sign,
it's
dude.
A peace sign, dude." And we're right back in America, even though Muslim America. Here's an interesting moment, a tough moment, where David Stacy's talking with a Muslim lawyer, Harris Ahmed. Let's listen.
One thing I want to make clear is that on 9/11, I do not think we should have to apologize for that, you know, as Muslims. Just as Christians shouldn't have to apologize for Eric Rudolph.
I, for one, would apologize for people like that.
Right. Well, there's a difference between condemnation and apology. Do we condemn what happened in 9/11 and the people that are behind that? Yeah, everybody condemns that. But as far as apologizing for it, it's saying, yeah, I was responsible for that in some way. And we're American, you know, so why should we be responsible for something that happened to us? They're going to assume that I think I'm part of the problem.
A West Virginia Christian getting down to a level of nuance and subtlety with a fellow American and Muslim at a level that you just don't see every day in Morgan Spurlock's 30 Days. A lot of callers want to join us. Morgan, let me turn to them. Tim is calling from Boston. Hi, Tim, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hello. First, I'd like to say I'm a huge fan of the show, and I've been watching since day one. But you asked what makes this different from regular reality TV.
Yeah.
I think the big difference is that in regular reality TV, you have all this soap opera sniping and personality conflicts.
Mm.
And in this show, when conflict comes, it comes from issues and beliefs. And I was just kind of curious as a question, is that just creative editing where you cut out that kind of garbage soap opera stuff? Or is it just really good casting and you haven't come across those conflicts? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Tim, thanks for calling. Morgan Spurlock, how about it? Are you editing out the sniping or just not piping it in?
Well, I mean, I think over the course of 30 days, I mean, we're shooting about 150 hours that we're then editing down to a 44-minute television program. So there is a lot of stuff that doesn't, you know, make the show. But I think that, you know, I think that what he brings up is, you know, that the point is it comes up from beliefs. It comes up from something that's very personal to these people. It isn't a created conflict. So by it being so personal and so real to them, what you're getting is real. Real debates. You're getting real emotion rather than something that I think is fabricated.
And what about the range of responses from, let's say, professional TV critics that you've had here? I mean, not everybody loves this. You know, here I'm looking at USA Today kind of going after you for binging on social issues. I have to say, I found it incredibly entertaining. But do you have, you know, the kind of cognoscenti?
Well, it is USA Today. You
know? Well, yeah, a lot of people read it. A million copies out there every morning.
It's the number one paper in America.
Right.
It's the number one paper.
Right. So...
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for me, I think that, you know, there's it's been a mixed bag, but I think the majority has been very positive. And I think that, you know, the show does strike a chord. I think that, you know, we have to start somewhere in creating an environment that makes talking about these issues acceptable, because we live in a world of complacency now where we don't talk about these things. We lock them in a closet. We shuffle them under the rug. And it has to start somewhere. It has to start with some sort of a dialogue. And that's what this show does. This show lights the fuse on a talk that needs to continue.
Really lights it up as far as I'm concerned. Paul is calling from Charlton, Massachusetts. Hi, Paula. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think? What have you seen?
I've seen Super Size Me, and I just had to say thank you so much, Morgan, for making that movie. My kids,
right on.
I have four little kids between the age of 6 and 5 months. they don't quite understand why we never, ever go to McDonald's anymore. But I've told them, Mommy watched a movie, and she now understands how bad it is, and we're never going. But they worked out a deal with me where they can go once a year on their birthday, but that's it.
Well, that sounds very, very like you're a good mom.
Oh, man. I just got to ask, though, your new show, it sounds great. I don't have cable. I don't have, I mean, all I have is what comes in over the airwaves on
right.
my TV. Are you ever going to have this show on DVD or videos?
Well, I just found out last week that Fox is going to be releasing it on DVD. I'm not sure when, if it's going to be, you know, just in time for the holidays, or if it's going to be next year. But they have said they're going to be releasing it, so that's great news.
Paula,
that would be great. It sounds great.
I hope you find it, and thanks very much for your call, Morgan. Tell us about the anti-aging segment. This is one I have not seen. I've read bits from it, but tell us about it.
Well, you know, in the United States, we hear steroids, and we think of. You know, we think of giant bodybuilders, you know, these big giant beefcake guys or the baseball players who are testifying before Congress. But what happens every day is there's millions of Americans who are taking steroids, you know, testosterone, human growth hormone to kind of regain their youth, that fountain of youth, you know, this vigor that they had when they were 18, 19, 20. And so we found a guy who had been thinking about, you know, doing this, diving into this type of therapy to get his body back to what it once was. He was a competitive swimmer for a long time and was totally shredded and had a six pack. And he just wanted to try and regain that. Now he's a middle-aged father. You know, he's about 35 and, you know, he's kind of done what most of us do and just kind of let his body fall away from him because of time and you know, kind of lack of energy and effort. And so for 30 days, he goes on this kind of anti-aging regimen of exercise and supplements. And I mean, his body really does start to go through the ringer.
And what's the chemical side of this regimen? We can imagine the exercise. What about the other side?
Yeah, I mean, the combination of, you know, human growth hormone, testosterone, steroids, and the supplements he was taking. He was taking a vast array of supplements that this doctor prescribed for him. And, I mean, there was a lot going into his body. And over the course of the 30 days, his liver starts to react. And not only that, but, you know, his sperm count starts to be heavily impacted.
We've got a little bit of tape on that very point where this is Scott Bridges, he who took the regimen, is at a fertility clinic, talking with the doctor there about his sperm count. Let's listen.
I have a bad news. There was no live sperm and occasionally dead sperm only. When you were here about a month ago, roughly, the quality of sperm was excellent. The 75 million, most of the sperm were live.
Right.
Now we have significantly less than 1 million and everything is dead.
Okay.
So something must have happened in between the last deposit and this deposit.
And what, in your experience, has happened?
Well, you probably have taken the medication which stopped production of sperm. But in our experience, I would assume that it will be reversible, that it will, you know, bounce back over a period of time.
Period of time,
when
meaning
that
how
would
long?
Well, that's a good question.
That's a good question. A lot of dead sperm. Morgan Spurlock, is this just because you put the poor guy on a bad regimen? I mean, if this is I would assume he would come out ripped and healthy. Instead, you've got him like a chemical wreck with a dead sperm.
Yeah, well, what started to happen is, you know, he was losing weight. He lost, I can't remember right off the top of my head, but it was a tremendous amount of weight over about 23 days he was on the program, and started to really look better and was feeling better, but it was just kind of what was happening internally. And this is a regimen that this doctor who prescribed it, it's not like I made it up, you know, this is what this guy does for patients all the time. And it should make you really start to question, you know, the decisions we make of what we put into our body and really having a better understanding, being a conscious consumer of kind of what we're buying and putting in ourselves.
How did your guinea pig in this one, the anti-aging segment, Scott Bridges, end up feeling about the experiment itself? Did he stick with it even for 30 days?
No, I mean, he quit early, and of all the 30 days that you see, he's the one out of the six, you know, where he's like, you know what, I can't keep doing this because, you know, I don't want to hurt myself, I don't want to hurt my body, I don't want to hurt my family. You know, my wife and I have been talking about having kids. You know, his wife, Timona, got incredibly upset over the course of the 30 days, especially once his sperm count had, you know, basically reached zero. There were no live sperm. And, you know, and I mean, he was really upset and was starting to tear at his family, and so he stopped. And everything's okay now, you know, once he went off the program and you know, continued to be active, you know, his sperm count came back and everything is fine. But I think it was a little wake up call for him about, you know, wanting the quick fix, the magic bullet. You know, when we take the shortcut to things, sometimes we get a little more than we bargain for.
Do your subjects sign releases, or are you released from liability before they go into their 30-day experiment?
Well, they're coming in. I mean, they're coming in complete volunteers, and they know the potential ramifications or what could happen. You know, we never know what's going to happen over the course of these journeys. But, you know, as I tell all of them when I speak to them, but, you know, beforehand, I would never put someone in a situation that I wouldn't be willing to go in myself. And so for me, that's the biggest thing, is I ask myself whenever we come up with these ideas, is would I do this?
We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Supersize Me filmmaker Morgan Spurlock about his new documentary series, 30 Days, on FX. You can join the conversation. Do you know what it's really like living entirely on minimum wage? Are you curious what life inside an American Muslim community is really like, right down to the call to prayer? Can you see yourself doing that for 30 days? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Supersize Me filmmaker Morgan Spurlock about his new documentary series, 30 Days, and his quite wonderful experiment with real reality TV. You can join us tonight. What do you think? With 500 channels, why aren't more filmmakers really crossing the lines of American culture? And what 30-day excursion would you recommend for Morgan Spurlock? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Deborah is calling from Dennis, Massachusetts. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to say, first of all, I've really been enjoying the show. Every time I end up driving home late, I end up turning on the radio in the house as soon as I get in.
It's great to have you. What do you think about Morgan Spurlock's work?
The thing that I appreciate most about it, and what I think really separates it from most so-called reality TV, is the respect that it's showing both for the participants and for the audience.
Yeah.
What I was hearing Morgan saying, you know, just earlier on the show about the gentleman who was on the steroids, you know, showed concern and respect for his decision and his choice. And so much of so-called reality TV seems to be going out of its way to demean the participants.
Deborah,
and
it's
to
a
make
great point.
Them
yeah.
Behave as badly as possible.
I think you're putting your finger on something right at the heart of this. And thanks for the observation, Deborah. And thanks for being there, Morgan Spurlock. Let me ask you about that. I mean, we would expect, given the kind of general TV culture today, that you would come in with kind of vicious caricature. I did not see that in what I saw here. You see the formula that is in regular reality TV. And, hey, lots of people love it, and it's a kind of escapism. But the reality part, nobody really buys anymore. How do you think about the balance between just digging for the heart of whatever 30-day experience you're in and entertainment value? Do you find yourself wanting to spice it up, to tweak it, to caricature once in a while?
Well, I mean, I think that would be the easy way out, no matter what would happen. I mean, that's the simple formula. If you're really going to create television as spectacle, you know, to get the racist who, you know, was in the KKK, who's now going to go live with this black family, or to find this guy who is, you know, this, you know, devout person of shipping all the Muslims out of the country in a post 9/11 world and moving him in with someone who's equally on the other side of the fence and in a Muslim community. You know, the problem is then it's very predictable what's going to happen. Not much. You know, people are going to come in with their ideas and their opinions, and they're going to stay exactly how they are, and something's going to get volatile, and there'll probably be a fight, and it'll have a very Springer-esque moment, and, you know, it'll be so predictable it's not interesting to watch. And what we have in 30 days is you find people who are very, very stuck in their opinions, who have a very definitive outlook on the world, but at the same point realize that we live in a world that's bigger than them and bigger than their ideals. And for me, I think that's an important thing for all of us to keep in mind.
And what about your brother-in-arms there, Michael Moore? When he goes after Charlton Heston, let's say, in Fahrenheit, Bowling for Columbine, is that Springer-esque to you? Is he crossing the line? Is that fair game? Is that something different from what you're up to?
You know, for me, I think that, you know, I'm a big fan of kind of letting people know what they're getting themselves into. And that's the one thing we try and do with the series, is people who, you know, are coming into this, there's really no surprises for them. They, from day one, we let people know what's going to happen, you know, along the way. We don't know how it's going to develop. You know, none of us do. That's the beauty of this program. And also, I think the beauty of human nature, that you can never predict how someone's going to react given in any moment. So, but the one goal for me is to never, you know, just kind of spring something on someone. I think that that's kind of a reality device that that as Deborah was talking about that we see a lot.
Let's take another call. Phil is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Phil. What do you think?
Hi. How you doing?
We're good. Phil, what's your advice? What's your thought?
I'm sorry. Yep. Can you hear me now?
Loud and clear. What do you say?
We lost you, Phil.
I think it would be interesting to try to act like Jesus. I'm an atheist myself, and I think to actually try to do no wrong from waking moments to the time I go to sleep would be incredibly difficult. I'm talking pollution, lifestyle. I mean, just the more I think about it, the more me and my friends, we've even talked about this. Yeah.
Well, there's a challenge, and it's got a kind of a spectacle angle built right in. I can imagine Morgan Spurlock, your fiance, Alexandra, rolling her eyes at that one. Oh, boy, here goes Morgan. He's going to be Jesus for 30 days. But to do no wrong for 30 days, that's a very challenging notion.
To do nothing wrong, and even just the idea of atheism, you know, we live in a very religious country. We live in a country whose roots are definitely religious-based. So I think to explore the idea of religion in America from an atheist point of view or even an agnostic, I think is something that we've talked about and that, you know, hopefully affects if they bring the show back, we can have a chance to do in the second season.
What are you anticipating if you tried to be an atheist for 30 days? I mean, is it really that hard to
avoid walking into church? Having an atheist, I think it's the other way around. I think, you know, it's taking an atheist and immersing him in a completely Christian environment and letting him kind of see what it's all about. You know, this community that he's kind of, you know, shunned for so long or doesn't believe or, you know, thinks is, you know, full of misinformation. You know, I think it could be a really engaging program.
And pick up Phil's suggestion here, Jesus or not, just the idea of doing no wrong for 30 days. How does Morgan Spurlock begin to think about a challenge like that?
Boy, I better start right now. I don't know. yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, to do that, to find somebody who, you know, has just enough, you know, just enough quirks and you know, and sins just enough, you know, like I think most people do to say, you know what, I'm going to give it a go would be hard. You know, because first you have to find somebody who's going to be completely honest about their lack of being perfect.
Yeah, tough to do. Lee is calling from Boston. Hi, Lee. What do you think, my friend?
Hi. Well, I haven't seen any of the TV shows. They sound very interesting and very intelligent. I think much more intelligent than the movie. I think the reason in part that the movie was so successful is that people really enjoy seeing other people behaving idiotically, and they find that entertaining. And I think the premise for it was idiotic. I mean, my son in elementary school knew that you don't go and order huge portions at any restaurant.
That is true. There was a kind of dumb and dumber quality to the fundamental premise of McDonald's for 30 days.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, but what I think the film represents is, you know, every day in America we overeat, we under-exercise, we make bad choices. You know, McDonald's themselves has a category of people. About 70% of the people who go to McDonald's are called heavy users, and that means they're going there, you know, about 3 or 4 times a week. So if you're going there 3 or 4 times a week, you know, I don't think you're going home and making veggie tofu stir fry the rest of the time. I mean, I think we're making bad choices consistently. And what I think the film is very representative of is what will happen to you over 10, 20, 30, 40 years of making these bad choices. You know, the health problems you see happen to me is what will happen to you over time. You know, diabetes, elevated cholesterol, heart disease, liver disease, all these will be yours over time.
But do you take Lee's point that there was a kind of circus angle to this one that I don't exactly see in your current 30-day series?
Well, I mean, I think what we did is, you know, my goal coming into this was, you know, as unrealistic as it may be to eat at McDonald's for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 30 days straight, you know, there are people who eat fast food consistently. A lot of us have turned this type of food into a cornerstone of our diet, and I think the film is very fun. I think the film still deals with a very serious issue in a way that makes it accessible, that makes it palatable, you know, no pun intended, but it actually makes it digestible for an audience, because nobody wants to be preached to. Nobody wants to be told what to do. If I would have made a very serious film about the obesity epidemic in America, nobody would have seen it. And what we've managed to do is create, not only with the film, but with the TV show, an environment where we can deal with serious issues in a way that doesn't make it seem heavy-handed. And I think that's really important.
Lee, thanks very much for your call. And kudos to your son for recognizing a diet he wouldn't jump on. Karen's calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. It's really nice to speak with you. I'm a video. I was a video student. I have a degree in video, and basically, Morgan, you're like living my dream.
Oh, right on.
I hope it's just obvious you're sending out a really positive message, open up some people's eyes. And I guess what I'm most curious about right now is how you find the people who participate in the show, and are they paid?
Good question. Thanks,
Karen. When we cast, you know, we cast in a variety of ways. You know, you don't have like a cattle call as like an American Idol does, you know, because we don't want to just have anybody. You know, we look for very specific people. You know, a perfect example is when we started looking for, you know, the gentleman who was going to go live with the gay man. You know, we started by asking, you know, gay people, or, you know, initially, do you have a relative who you've been estranged from, or do you know somebody that you're not connected to? And, you know, we tried to open doors that led us to this person who may go off and live with someone else. You know, that's so we try and do it in channels that you wouldn't normally cast through. And the people who go away for a month, you know, they are giving up their lives, they're giving up their jobs. So we are paying them, but not like an exorbitant sum of money. You know, we're making sure they don't lose money by going away. And that's the thing, is we don't want them to feel like that they're making a sacrifice by coming to do this. You know, we want them to, you know, be able to go, step right back into their life, you know, with the money that they would have had no matter what.
But for example, your fellow West Virginian who went to live with the Muslim family for a month, was it
correct?
Was he a personal friend, someone you knew through family? How did you find him?
Well, it was really interesting with David Stacey. When we first started casting for the Muslim episode, I said, you know, I really wanted to get somebody from my home state. I thought that there would be a good personal connection by it being a Christian from where I grew up. And so we started reaching out to churches. We started reaching out to different places. And David Stacey's name came up. And I said, oh, my gosh, I know David Stacey. I know that guy. Mm. And so we had him come. We sat him down. We videotaped him. We took his tape to the network and showed him to the network. And they loved it. You know, they loved the guy. And I think he's a very affable human being. He's somebody who is very in touch with his emotions.
Very sincere. Didn't seem like a setup job at all. You could see him really working through the issues that he felt personally here.
Exactly. And it's finding that person, you know, who I think is going to be honest with themselves as they're going through this process.
Morgan, tell us about a couple of the episodes, one that I haven't seen, one that hasn't aired yet. But first, the straight man spending 30 days with a gay couple in San Francisco. What issues came up? What was interesting there?
Well, I think one of the ones that came up immediately, Ryan Hickmott, who is the gentleman who moved out to live with Ed in San Francisco. He lived with one gay man. It wasn't a couple. It was just gay guy. Yeah. And, you know, the biggest thing for Ryan is a Christian, you know, grew up in a very Christian household. And for him, it was dealing with the issue of it being a sin against God by being a homosexual. And so he went out there and, you know, and the experience humanized it for him, meeting these people, knowing that they have a lot of the same, you know, goals, hopes, dreams, fears that he has, but still it was the struggle of, you know, but what you're doing is wrong. The Bible says it's wrong, mm-hmm. So it's wrong. And it was seeing him kind of work through that issue, which once again, at the end, I don't think he, you know, was completely convinced, but at the same point, I think he, you know, still had some questions, which that's a great thing, just to plant those seeds so that, you know, we'll all go out and seek out more information.
And was his gay host in the show offended by this, or did he just take it on board and you know, work with it? And
was it
realistic the way he handled it with the camera always there?
Yeah. Well, I think that what happens is after a day or so, you know, the cameras become so secondary to these people's relationship that you're just seeing develop and the experiences that they're having. And there was a great scene in the show where he had just come back from meeting with, I think it was he went to a gathering because he's an Army reservist, and he went to a gathering of gay veterans. And there were guys there who were in the Korean War and the Vietnam War. Mm. And there was a World War II veteran who was there, who was like at the Battle of the Bulge. And here he was surrounded by these gay veterans and suddenly saw that there, you know, were a lot of, you know, gays in the military who were just like him and, you know, fought for this country and believed in it. So he came home and started telling Ed this story about meeting with these people. But he says, I still believe it's wrong. It's still a sin. Mm. And he goes, it's a sin, just like murder. And he's like, so you're comparing me to a murderer for what I do? Mm. He said, you're saying that's wrong. And he goes, well, maybe it's not the same. He goes, yeah, but that's what you're comparing it to. And so, I mean, I think that there were things that made Ryan start to see that, well, maybe everything that he thinks may not be, you know, the way that everybody else sees it. You know, it kind of just opened his mind to new experiences, which is important.
Getting right down to the nub there. Alex is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What I really find fascinating about your show is that it seems like you're really putting discourse into reality television. And it's something I've really felt like is lacking in a lot of the shows that I see. But I wonder if that's something that's really tenable. I mean, can you have discourse be now a major part of reality television? Or do you think this is something that just doesn't fit with the fun and the wildness of a lot of shows?
Alex, let me ask you, what do you mean by discourse? I mean, that people, they're not exactly sitting around like a college seminar. You may not have seen these, but they're living real lives. but a kind of discourse being played out through those real...
Right, but they're being put in a situation where they have an opportunity to understand someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to put in a situation where it's merely entertaining that these two people are interacting.
Yeah.
And I think it's fascinating myself, and that's what I would pay to watch, but I don't know if that's something that really is exciting to the public and marketable.
But so are Spurlock and Survivor are permanently on two different islands. Alex, thanks for the call. Morgan, how about it?
Well, I mean, you know, millions of people are tuning in to watch 30 Days every week. So there's obviously a demand for it. You know, there's obviously a hunger for something that really deals with some issues, and that actually does begin this dialogue and this discourse, as he suggested. And, you know, for me, there's so many people that I've met on the street, so many people that I've run up to, who've come up to me that have said that, you know, the next day at work, like, everybody watches the show and they're all talking about it. So, I mean, what's being generated from this show, I think, is a really positive thing. And I can only hope that, you know, this is the beginning of more programming like this.
Now, Binge Drinking Mom, this one is on tomorrow night. And I've got to say, the marquee sounds pretty sensational. I mean, what's the Spurlock redeeming factor here?
Well, I mean, for me, I think we live in a nation where, you know, there are more and more people, you know, college students, you know, spend more on alcohol than on textbooks. You know, that's the world we live in. As did I, as did every other kid I went to college with. And I went out, you know, 3-4 days a week, as did, you know, a lot of people, and as do the kids that we met while shooting this episode, you know, all across America.
And what are you hoping for the daughter to see what happens to her mother when her mother kind of matches her drink for drink?
Well, the goal for the mother was to try and let the daughter see what she's doing to herself. You know, the repercussions of her actions. You know, that she's not really thinking beyond, you know, what she's doing right then. You know, it's just all about having drinks, all about having good times, and not thinking that there could be other problems that would arise from this, not only health wise, but, you know, in terms of a relationship. You know, could it be, you know, leading to a car accident or date rape or anything? And so the mother just tries to show her, because it's almost like the daughter is blinded, that she can't see what she's doing to herself, and the mother wants to turn the mirror on her and show her by her own recourse.
Morgan, what's next for you?
You know, hopefully we'll get to do another season of 30 Days. You know, that would be my first choice. You know, I hope that we can make that happen. You know, we've got some films in development. You know, next year I want to make another documentary, and, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, that we have steaming in the hopper. But, you know, right now 30 Days has been taking up most of my time.
And does Binge Drinking Mom survive 30 Days of binge drinking? She must come out a wreck. I can't imagine.
Yeah. Be sure to tune in tomorrow.
Morgan Spurlock, it's been terrific talking with you. We thank you for your work. It's really terrific. And
thank you, Tom,
for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Morgan Spurlock joined us from New York. He is the Academy Award-nominated director of Super Size Me, creator, producer, and host of the 6-part TV series on FX, 30 Days. Also author of Don't Eat This Book, Fast Food and the Supersizing of America. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Marika Bukas, and Alan Cockle. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.